Okay, our second argument is in Appeal Number 21-1826, BLSI Technologies v. Intel. Mr. Lowenstein.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court. I'm joined by my colleague, Colette Wu. We have two errors of claim construction from the Board on the docket. I would like to start with the second issue first in the interest of time. So the claim says being used for electrical interconnection. The Board's construction is an error because it found that that limitation, being used for electrical interconnection, can be met by something that has no electrical use at all. You have in Kanaoka M1 and M2, which are completely surrounded by dielectric material. No electricity can travel to it or from it.
Kanaoka says that those metal lines are electrically connected. I mean, that's the exact quoted phrase from Kanaoka, right?
You're correct, and it's...
So I guess your view is electrically connected doesn't always mean electrically connected?
I think it's a translated patent and is using language in an odd fashion. But here's what it means. We gave an analogy in our brief. They did not dispute it. It's like if I had a towel, had two pennies in the towel on top of each other, and I close it up, Kanaoka would say that's electrically connected because I have two conductive pieces of metal touching each other. Even though there's no electrical use, provide a different analogy about a wobbly table, and one of the legs is not quite as long. I stack some pennies underneath it. Kanaoka would say that's electrically connected. Obviously, whether it is or not, it's not being used for electrical interconnection. So you're absolutely right, but it's an odd usage of language, let's say.
Okay. Maybe you can walk through your sources for why the claim construction for being used for electrical interconnection demands that there's actually that these metal interconnect layers are actually designed for conducting electricity.
You mean in the context of the claim, of course, right? Yeah, so I would say, first of all, starting with the plain meaning of the claim, it says being used for electrical interconnection. So I would say the case could be decided on that point, not the case, but the claim construction issue.
Relying principally on the verb used.
Used for, yes, being used for. And now, Your Honors have cases where you say, you have plenty of cases where you require an actual purpose. You have cases where you say the structure has to be configured for a particular purpose. You have cases where you say it has to be capable of a particular purpose, usually dictated by the language of the claim. Here, it says used for. Whichever one of those, it has to mean something. And whichever one of those three means of construing a claim it is, Kanaoka does not meet it. Because it's not capable of electrical use, it's not configured for electrical use, and it's certainly not used for electrical interconnection. And you don't need to get into the thorny factual question of what does Kanaoka actually do. All you need to decide is that we argued that Kanaoka has no electrical use based on Kanaoka's teaching, and the board said, we don't care. That's irrelevant under our claim construction.
I saw that your claim 20 also has a separate limitation about adding dummy metal lines.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like Kanaoka's metal lines, M1, M2, are in fact dummy metal lines.
Yes.
And so is there an inference here with the recitation of dummy metal lines in the claim that whatever's going on here with this used for electrical interconnection for the interconnect layers can't possibly be dummy metal lines themselves?
I think that's a reasonable inference. I haven't fully assessed it in quite that way, but that certainly sounds very reasonable to me. And it's in keeping with the specification as a whole. So if you look at the background of the invention, it says, you know, in the prior art, you had these dummy layers for interconnects with vias to support the structure of the bond pad. And even, you know, where there's no conductivity going on. And one of the principal advantages of our patent, it's at the bottom of column 3, beginning of column 4, is that you can make each of them by interspersing dummy metal lines, increasing the density. You can allow each layer of the metal interconnect to be functionally independent, not only from the bond pad above, but from each other.
Is there any, taking a step back from the specific language used in the patents, is there any magic to, given the justification for having these chunks of metal in the middle of the force region, is there any reason that it's useful that they be electrically conductive, or is it simply the fact that they are strengthened the area beneath the bond pad so that it resists crushing from the adhesive force?
So I think there are two different issues. In our patent, the bulk of the teaching is not really before your honors, but the bulk of the teaching is you're putting dummy filler throughout layers of the...
Right, I understand that. And you want to strengthen the structure. I understand that. But suppose you were strengthening the structures that matter, whether you're strengthening it with something that's conductive as opposed to non-conductive, since they're not doing any conducting.
I would say it's not the question of whether it's conductive or not, because I'm not talking about the dummy metal. I'm talking about what our patent says is the advantage of adding this dummy metal,
right,
is it allows you to use these metal interconnect layers that used to be there just for structural support like you find in Kanaoka. And so the principal benefit, one of the substantial benefits, I think it says, something like that, is you allow each of the interconnects to use independent of the bond pad and independent of each other because you have the support sufficiently elsewhere. So it is an advantage of the patent that you can use, electrically use, each layer independently.
When you say electrically use?
Yes.
In what sense are they being electrically used?
So we're not Kanaoka. Kanaoka, there is no electrical use at all.
Right.
What our patent says is you can remove the vias between these layers, because if you have vias between the layers and up to the bond path, it's just going to be one pathway.
Right.
And so what our patent says is if you find sufficient support by adding dummy metal elsewhere in the surrounding areas, you can now take out the vias and use these layers for actual electrical purposes. And that's what's captured in the
plan. Give an example of what that would be. What would be an electrical purpose for using these interconnect layers?
So I think you have to think about in line with the bond pad. So what our patent allows is because you remove the vias, you can have pathways that extend to, let's say, the neighboring bond pad. So you would have an electrical use not connected to the bond pad. And I'm not saying that the claim has to be that the two layers are not electrically connected so long as there's an electrical use. But I'm saying an advantage of the patent, the teachings of the patent, is that they can be independent of the bond pad and independent of each other. Are there any other questions, or should I turn to the force region issue? Okay.
You're about the force region.
So, okay, force region, I think, again, we have several errors of claim construction. And there's actually fairly little dispute on some of the issues before your honors. So the regulation is clear. If we timely submit a claim construction determination from a district court, the board must consider it. There is no dispute that the preamble and the trial practice guide should be followed here. They don't dispute it. They don't say it's not allowed deference.
What if we conclude that as a functional de facto matter, the board did consider the district court claim construction when it considered Intel's proposed construction, which was identical to the district court's construction, and then after looking at it and evaluating it in light of the intrinsic evidence, the board simply said, well, we understand that, you know, there's this one statement in the spec that suggests that the notion of a die attach should be involved with the claim construction, but we think, in fact, that's just a single embodiment, and that's an overly narrow choice to make for claim construction for force region, and there are other statements in the specification that lead us to conclude that it needs to be something broader. By doing that kind of evaluation of the entire patent, it seems to me that given that the district court's construction was proposed and it was evaluated and then ultimately rejected, that the board did in fact consider and then declined to adopt the district court construction.
So there's a lot of responses to that. I'll try to wrap it all together.
Well, so I guess what would be the point for the board to say, and by the way, the construction that's being proposed by Intel was a construction that a district court adopted at Markman.
So I think from the board's perspective, there is a very, very different thing between a party's claim construction and a district court's claim construction determination. And so the board has many errors in force region, one of which is it did not consider, address, or give appropriate weight to the district court determination. But it also did not mention that both parties agreed with that determination. And so the whole purpose of that regulation...
But it was aware of that. construction, right? It was the one proposed by Intel.
It was aware of Intel's construction. I don't know that it was aware or considered the district court's determination that that was the correct construction. And it also did not say that we agreed with that construction. And so you have a situation where both parties, I'm not sure if I did I answer your
question? Well, I'm just trying to understand if you're being overly technical with some requirement that the board actually has to say that this one proposed construction was the district court's construction in this one market.
I don't think so, because the whole point of that rule...
They rejected the construction, though. I mean, isn't the whole point of that regulation is if the claim has been construed in district court litigation, the board has to at least consider that construction before arriving at a different one. But they did consider that construction here, and they arrived at a different one. You may have better arguments about why that one's incorrect, but they clearly considered the district court construction, right?
Well, I agree with everything you said except for the last three words. Right.
No. Yeah. Well, is the construction that was proposed by Intel in this case identical to the district court's construction?
Yes.
And they considered Intel's construction and rejected it.
They considered it as Intel's construction.
But that's where you're being overly technical. I think you're basically saying they got to check off the box and say, we knew this was a district court's construction and we reject it. But the whole point of this is just so that when there's claim construction going on in district courts, that the board be aware of the claim construction and provide a reason why it's not going to adopt it. It did all of that here.
It just didn't
add the sentence that said, oh, by the way, we know the district court adopted a different one. Well, so, who cares? We know why they adopted the claim construction they did, and we know they disagreed with the one that the district court adopted. I mean, again, you may have good arguments about why the board's one is to...
Well, maybe I should, in the interest of time, maybe I should turn to that.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. So I think
before you do, let me just straighten out something that I maybe a misapprehension on my part, but very quickly. Earlier, I think you said that it was not clear whether the district court's claim construction had been presented at any point to the board as the district court's claim construction.
Did I misunderstand you? Yeah, that's not what I meant.
So the district court's claim construction, the board was aware of what the claim construction was, and number two, that the district court had adopted it, correct?
I can't make that inference. All I can say
is, I say aware. Was that fact presented to the board
many
in some
times.
Of the briefing?
Many times.
So the board was, at least we'll assume the board was aware, constructively aware.
They should have been aware.
Okay.
But they should have addressed it under power integrations, and they should have...
All right, so your argument is that what they should have had is a footnote saying that this construction was adopted by the district court.
No, they should have assigned it appropriate weight. It's not a de novo review for the board.
And we think it is entitled to no weight because we think it's wrong. That footnote would satisfy you.
Well, there's supposed to be factors that they're supposed to consider in both the preamble and the trial practice guide. And there's no dispute that the factors weigh in favor of keeping the district court construction. But in the interest of time, I may move on to the issue Judge Hughes, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Go to the issue Judge Hughes went to, which is that clearly, their construction is wrong under Amaranth. It just repeats something that's in the claim. If you adopted their construction, it would take out the word force region. It would say a region at least directly under the bond pad, at least directly under the bond pad.
Before we get into the merits of the claim construction, assume for the moment we agree with that claim construction.
Mm-hmm.
Then does that just mean it's an affirm?
I would urge you to reach a different conclusion for two reasons. The first is, if you reach that conclusion, the regulation, trial practice guide, the preamble become a dead letter. It's a
what?
Become a dead letter.
Okay, put that to the side.
Okay, let's put that to the side. I have a second argument, which is that under SAS, Quibin Clica, Magnum Oil, the petition, guides to the petition, where it's an undisputed claim construction, particularly one that the district court adopts. And both parties are urging the board to adopt that construction. There should be no basis for the board to reach a different conclusion. That's inconsistent with SAS, which says, look, you can't pick some claims.
So let me get, you're making the argument that if both sides are proposing the same construction, the board is not allowed to consider a different construction that it believes is the actual correct construction. It is barred from considering, let's assume for the moment, for my hypothetical, that the board knows what the real construction should be, and but nevertheless is required and bound to follow what the two parties propose to be the construction, even though it's wrong.
So your rule is a little bit stronger than what I would have proffered, which is that, not that they're precluded, we can't predict all cases and all circumstances that may come up, or strange circumstances under the sun. Maybe a party does something that affirmatively contradicts the, there are all kinds of things that can happen. But certainly there ought to be a very good reason to depart.
What if the very good reason is that the construction that the two parties landed on is wrong?
I still think under, not to repeat myself, but I still think under the trial practice guide in the preamble, they had to assign an appropriate weight.
No. I don't think we're talking about the district court stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Even if you agreed in the petition, I know that's where you agree, but even if you agree, say the petitioner proposes something, you respond and say, yeah, that's okay. And then the PTAB says, no, you're both wrong. Here's the correct construction. Are you saying they can't do that?
I think that's the logical conclusion I draw from SAS, Koenig-Klick, and Magnemore.
Where in any of those cases does that say that? I mean, the whole point of the PTAB is to take another look at validity, and if their hands are tied by improper claim construction just because you two have agreed to it, then they're going to get to the wrong invalidity decision, aren't they?
So I may not be aware of it, but I don't believe this court...
What language in Magnum Oil or those cases say that the PTAB is bound by the party's agreement? I thought those cases were about the board coming up with new claim constructions for the first time and not giving you all an opportunity to respond. Don't shake your head at me.
No. What I mean is we're not making a due process argument.
Please show me in those cases where it says the board is bound by an agreed-upon claim construction.
So I don't think it's – what I'm arguing is it's a logical extension from the reasoning of those cases. I didn't mean to be intemperate. What SAS says is the petition's driving everything. And what Koenig-Klick says...
But we said in other cases that the board is allowed to come up with a new claim construction as long as it gives the parties notice. So how is your logical extension consistent with those cases?
Because I don't believe this court has ever held, and I'm sorry if I'm not aware of it, where there's an undisputed claim construction that it's appropriate for the board to reach. And if you look at a lot of the language, it's about disputed claim construction.
You wouldn't argue that that's true of a district court claim construction, right? In other words, if the parties agree on a claim construction, the district court says, I think you're both wrong. Here's the claim construction. You're not arguing the district court is disabled from doing that.
Well, my argument would not follow to the district court because the precedents I'm citing are all specific.
Well, I understand, but I'm trying to see how broad this proposition is, whether it's somehow limited to things the board can't do that a district court could do, or whether you're saying, well, the district court couldn't do it either.
No, my argument is not intended to extend to the district court, and I don't believe logical.
And then, so what's the difference?
Because SAS...
We'll have to look at those cases, but setting aside the citation of cases, is there any principled basis for distinguishing what the district court can do in this setting versus what the board can do in this setting, assuming, as Judge Hughes has said, that there's due process opportunity to contest the claim?
Yeah. And just to be sure, I'm not arguing anything about due process, but I think there is a distinction fundamentally about IPRs.
And where does it come from, that distinction?
So what this court has held many times is the IPRs are a special breed. They move fast. You have to prove your case in the petition. That guides everything. It's not like a district court complaint. It's like the entire case in chief is the petition and the exhibits there too. So you gotta prove your case in the petition. And what it follows is, look, if we disagree with the claim construction, then of course the board can find a different construction. But if they say X, we say X, and the district court says X, I know you have to go back to the cases, but how under those precedents can the board in this hyper fast,
I guess the theory, the counter theory would be, if at institution the board recognizes there is a claim construction problem with what the parties appear to have agreed upon as being a construction of a particular term, the board could identify that, reach a different claim construction and then adjust and see if the existing unpatentability theory in the petition still can appropriately apply under the adjustment to the claim construction.
So, in fact, that's
what happened here, in the sense that the board, as I saw it in the institution, well, go ahead and respond to that before I get into the actual facts of this case.
I see where you're going, and I will allow that what I'm arguing is a logical extension of existing law.
But when you say logical existence of existing law, you mean your interpretation of those cases. There's nothing in the statutes or regulations that suggests that the board can't disagree with the parties on claim construction, right?
Well, except insofar as SAS is driven by the statute.
Not the cases.
No, SAS is the
law. I know what SAS is.
Okay, fair enough.
Assume we just disagree with your logical extension. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that suggests the board is bound in the statutes or the regulations.
Well, except that the petition, again, that's what gets instituted, that's what gets tried. And as filtered through the analysis, that's what sets the stage for everything.
And SAS did not say if the petition proposes a construction and the patent owner doesn't disagree, that the board at institution can't still say, we don't think this is the right construction to look at in determining validity. Here's the proper construction. Parties go out and address it under that. SAS doesn't prevent that, does it? SAS just prevented the board from partial institution and said you had to look at the petition. It didn't say you can't have a different claim construction in looking at the theories of invalidity. Where in SAS does it say that?
Obviously, this specific question was not before the court in SAS. But what SAS did say, and I don't mean to be a broken record, what SAS did say is the petition drives the entire life of the complaint. If you institute, you have to institute on everything. And so consequently,
you've taken up all your time on these technical arguments about why the board couldn't go beyond what it did and not even address whether the board's actual claim construction was wrong and whether you have a different construction that makes any difference here.
Well, I believe under Amaranth, clearly the board's construction is at best disfavored because it's just repeating something that's already in the claim. So, you're ignoring the party's agreement and the district court to put in a redundant construction.
It might be disfavored, but what if after a review of the intrinsic evidence, it compels that result? There's nothing in patent law that prevents claim construction of a term from essentially being, a restatement of other words that are in the claim. Is that?
It's disfavored. That's what I can say. Right. Under simpler, it's disfavored. Under Amaranth, it says you ought not to render claims meaningless. So it's a generally speaking, an ill-advised way to do claim construction, I think, is a fair statement of this court's law.
But, the claim term we're all talking about, a force region, at least under the bond pad, characterized by being susceptible to defects due to stress applied to the bond pad, right? I guess if I were to look at this intrinsic evidence of the spec and conclude that a force region is defined in this patent as being all of these very words in this claim limitation that follows the word force region, that is, a region at least under the bond pad characterized by being susceptible to defects due to stress applied to the bond pad, then wouldn't that result in an affirm here? Putting aside your technical arguments about the trial practice guide or SAS or something like that.
So I think the way you phrased it, it's a tautology. So under the way you phrased it, the answer would probably be yes as to the force region questions. However, I just want to make one point clear. If you find that the board can reach a new construction, particularly where the district court affirmed it, on its own, sua sponte, where there's no dispute, I do believe you'd be making new law in that direction. And so that's the only thing I would
question. What if we read the institution decision as having done two things with this force region? One was to analyze the patentability of the force region limitation in view of ODA under an understanding that force region merely requires it to be an area at least under the bond pad. And then found, ODA meets that understanding of the limitation. and then said, in addition, we also find that OTA meets this claim limitation under Intel's proposed construction, which has the die-attach part. It, in that way, the institution decision will have applied both of these two different understandings of the term force region in a way that puts everybody on notice that the board was thinking of this force region term in at least two different ways in terms of understanding what is the scope of that term.
I agree.
Including the claim construction that it ultimately adopted.
I'm not making any argument about notice or opportunity to respond.
Right. So I guess the point is that what the board's construction that it ultimately landed on was in play as soon as the institution decision came out, because it read the petition as proposing two different understandings of the claim term.
There are a lot of questions there. I think as to that last point, I don't think that's a plausible reading of the petition. And then the other thing that you...
But it appears to be that's the way the board read the petition.
Okay.
Because it actually did perform the unpatentability analysis in light of that second understanding of force region.
I would agree with you that they did that, but what I would say is that is not a plausible reading of what the petition actually proposed. And that's because they were just covering their bases on an indefinite argument that they made in the district court. And so they didn't want us to argue, well, you can't go forward with an IPR because you already the claim is indefinite. So they were just covering their bases on that.
I have just a very quick question, a factual question. The term die attach is only used three times in the patent and never in a definitional sense. Is it your view that the term die attach includes forms of attachment to the bond pad that involve adhesion by force, compression, but not wire bonding?
I think that's substantially correct. There's a very... Almost the entire argument below was about whether a wire bond is a die attach.
Yeah.
And there's reams of evidence on it. I didn't want to ask you guys to find, make a factual finding in the first instance on it. But I think it's very clear in the literature, at least from our view, that die attach is a separate and distinct process from a wire bond. And
what is where is the line of distinction drawn between the two?
Just put simply, die attach is you're attaching the chip to the substrate, and then if it's a wire-bonded package, you're attaching wires thereafter.
So you're wrapping it with wires as opposed to having an adhesive or a pressure contact, right?
I would disagree if it's a term wrapping. I mean, you're attaching, but yes.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Yeah, that answers my question.
If there's nothing else, I'll save whatever time you guys have got. We'll allow
you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
It is time to hear from the other side. Mr. Walden?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Calvin Walden, and with me at the council table today is Gregory Israelson and Vishal Amin from Intel's head of IP patent policy. He's here as well. So if it misplays the court, I'll start with the Claim 1 and the force region issue. I want to just follow from some of the questions that were just being asked of council about whether the Qualcomm case, the SAS case, the materials case really support this extension, the logical extension that counsel for VLSI is arguing for. And we submit that it doesn't. Qualcomm case simply stands for the proposition that the parties to an IPR need to have notice or an opportunity and an opportunity to be heard if the board is going to deviate from the district court's construction. Judge Chin, I believe, pointed out fairly well, this happened here because in the institution decision, the board has already decided that they did not need to go with lexicography.
There is one factual dispute or issue between this case and Qualcomm. I believe in Qualcomm, the claim construction issue was in dispute between the two parties. And here, VLSI is contending that it was undisputed. You proposed a construction, they accepted it, and then the board on its own went off and migrated away and located its own construction.
That is true in the exact procedural posture differs there.
And so is that a distinction with a real difference in that at least in Qualcomm, the board was put to the test. It had to confront the claim construction process.
We submit that it does not. The reason being, once again, claim construction is a matter of law. The board's obligated to follow the Phillips. They need to follow the law and apply the law. And we believe that's what they did. They do need to provide the parties an opportunity to address a construction if they're going to deviate. Whether it's from an agreed upon construction or from two different constructions from the parties, but still they come up with a third.
Mr. Lowenstein says that's just wrong in light of the whole structure and purpose of the IPR process. Is there any authority that you can point us to within the board that gives the board the power to say no, even though the parties may agree on a claim construction, or even though the parties may not have raised a particular claim construction that the board chooses to adopt?
I'm not aware of
setting aside due process.
Certainly understood. I'm not aware of an affirmative statement that says the board may deviate. But what I'm aware of are the decisions that say that the board may deviate in terms of Qualcomm. I'm aware of the rule that says that the board is required to consider the district court's construction. But I think this clear inference from that is that they're not obligated to follow that construction.
Well, no, but the question would be, are they obligated to follow it in the assumption that the parties agree with the district court's construction?
Well, I think, again, there's still nothing that obligates the board to do that. There's no case law that supports that. There's no inference that would require it.
Well, the district court certainly wouldn't be required to do
that. Right. If the district court thought that the parties were wrong with their construction, then the district court would be, in fact, obligated to follow the law and come up with the proper construction. We believe the same applies to the board. There's nothing that limits the board in that way. And there's certainly the legal precedent, we believe, that allows for that to happen. And so that's what the board did here. Now, the board, I don't want to belabor this point, but we do put into our brief that the board did consider the district court's construction. The construction is the same construction that Intel offered. Intel offered it for the same reasons based on the lexicography that we submit exists in column 3 of the patent. And so they had the reasoning, they had the actual construction, they had the board's opinion, they had the parties telling the board multiple times that the district court had come up with this opinion, and they said that they had reviewed the entire record. So with that, I believe there's more than sufficient evidence to support the conclusion that the board did in fact consider the district court's construction, and that they were not obligated to say it out loud
whether the patent board here unilaterally applied its own claim construction. As I talked about with your friend on the other side, it appeared to me that the institution decision, the patent board, was applying two different understandings of force region to find and found that ODA appeared to meet both of those different understandings of force region. Would you say that your petition presented two different proposed constructions or understandings of force region?
We did. We actually presented three. We presented the construction that the district court had followed and that Intel has advocated for. At the time of the petition, counsel for VLSI was not agreeing to that construction, but had offered at the district court a broader construction. And so in our petition, we said, Intel explained that ODA discloses a force region under the district court's construction and under the construction argued for by counsel for VLSI. And in fact, we provided a third construction, which was simply that there's no doubt, or there should be no dispute, that a force region includes that area under the bond pad, and that ODA discloses that as well. That's all described in the actual final written decision of the board, where they laid out that Intel had offered or had submitted evidence that ODA discloses a force region under any of these three constructions. And so when the board in its initial determination to institute stated that, okay, ODA does disclose, or at least the preliminary evidence shows that it discloses a force region under a broader construction, but also under this construction that it requires a die attach, That was, again, I think, consistent with what Intel had put into the petition. And we submit that actually carries forward to the final determination as well, where, yes, the board determined that it did not need to find lexicography, that the force region can be construed simply as the region under the bond pad. But I believe, you know, as we've put into our brief, they went further, and on page 30 of their appendix, they stated that OTA discloses a force region as well if you include the die-attach requirement. And when a reference discloses a limitation under any of the possible constructions, then debate over which is the correct construction becomes less material. And so the board had confronted with this construction dispute. They made a preliminary determination. They then followed it with the final determination that, yes, the force region includes the area under the bond pad. No, the force region should not be limited to the specific embodiment of figures 1 and 2, and that they didn't need to determine anything more because that resolved the disputes before it under the Vivid and NIDAC cases. Then the board was within its reason not to construe the claim any further and simply to determine that OTA does disclose this force region under any of these potential constructions. And that makes sense. Judge Bryson asked about what's the difference between a die attach and the wire bonding of OTA. There is no difference. Wire bonding is one of the most typical and historically known forms of a die attach. It was the
main. That's a critical question. And
yes,
sir. If in fact die attach, as used in the patent, never mind what shows up in a electrical engineering dictionary, but if, as used in the patent, die attach includes wire bonding, game is over because the references on column 5 and 6 then line up with the reference on column 3.
That's correct.
So,
there's no
and
reason.
Yet we have no guidance from parties or anyone else, as far as I can see, as to whether the patent is using the term die attach in the broad sense that you're advocating, or whether there is so much authority out there saying die attach means something that excludes wire bonding, that you can't read these three references as consistent.
I think Your Honor has put your finger on the point. I believe, though, we have submitted that the die attach in the patent itself very clearly covers wire bonding. The patent is all about what happens when you put pressure onto a bond pad during this attach or bonding
and
process.
And wire bonding, I take it, does impose pressure.
Yes, that's correct. You have to individually put a wire onto that bond pad and make that physical and electrical connection. You have to put pressure down on that.
Okay.
And in fact, OTA talks about that. That is the point of OTA. There are pressures underneath the bond pad, just like the 552 patent describes.
Well, where in the four corners of this patent would I find something that would tell me that die attach includes wire bond?
Well, I think the most explicit statement is on column 2 of the patent that specifically states that the bond pads include wire bond pads. So if you look
there's no doubt that that's true, but the question is what does die attach a subset of all bonding mechanisms.
I have only the portion of the patent that specifically, I believe, makes the connection to wire bonding. The only other portions you've noted, there are die attaches mentioned, but generally it's within specific examples.
Yeah.
And in those examples, it is an example of what they call a flip chip, but there's nothing in the patent that would support the inference that they're trying to somehow distinguish from wire bonding, which they do mention in column 2. Column 2 describes the types of bond pads that are going to be subject to forces underneath them when there is this attachment or bonding process. The rest of the patent, when you get to the lexicography on column 3, yes, it is in the context of that figures 1 and 2, but it's not limited to that. And then, of course, there's a reference to the force region later, which talks about assembly or other processes in a broader way. And I believe the board in this instance correctly found that there's just nothing in this patent that would support the conclusion that the force region should exclude wire bonding. And that includes when it has this definition of a die attach.
The language of the force region limitation itself just simply says, at least under the bond pad, and then characterized by being susceptible to defects due to stress applied to the bond pad. And the board, in fact, applied all of that claim language in the context of ODA at A30, and then found petitioner alleges and sufficiently shows that ODA teaches the subject matter of claim element 1B because ODA teaches a force region directly under the bond pad by disclosing that the region under the bond pad is susceptible to defects, i.e. cracks, as a result of the load of a needle during wire bonding. And then, moreover, the 552 patent also describes force region as, quote, a region in which interconnect layers of the stack of interconnect layers are susceptible to stress from the bond pad due to assembly or other processes, end quote, column 6. So in that way, the board already made a particular fact finding about what ODA's wire bonding can do to a force region.
Yes. And so
what I'm wondering is, would you think that perhaps the best understanding of force region is just simply a restatement of all of the words in that force region limitation? Not just the at least under the bond pad, but at least under the bond pad characterized by being susceptible to?
I think that is a fair definition for force region. In this way, there's more than one way to make a construction, especially when you're only obligated to construe a term necessary to decide the issues before you. But that's correct. The force region is under the bond pad. It's characterized by being susceptible to stress. We had submitted that it is as a part of this die attach. And this is when you get stresses on the bond pads. When you attach that chip, that die, to another component, whether it's a substrate or a circuit board, you're putting physical pressure on those chips. And that is the same for flip chip bonding, which is the figures 1 and 2 example, or wire bonding, which is ODA. In any of those instances, you're putting that physical and electrical pressure on that bond pad, meaning you're going to have those stresses underneath the bond pad. And the last thing I'll say about that is this is not a dispute that the teachings of the 552 patent are applicable to wire bonding. Their expert has agreed with that. So what we're really talking about is this attempt to redefine die attach to exclude wire bonding. And we believe the board very clearly correctly held that that's not excluded. And that's all they had to find because of what ODA discloses.
You have a few seconds left to talk about being used for electrical interconnection.
I will do that. I have 2 points that I'd like to make very quickly if I could, Your Honors. The first point about Claim 20 is that it's an odd claim. It is.
I think we can all agree to that.
What's that? I'm sorry?
We can all agree to that.
It's a method claim for an integrated circuit, but it's not a method for using that circuit. It's not even a method for making that circuit. Instead, it's a method for designing an integrated circuit in which you have to start with, with the circuit design. Then you move to developing a layout for the integrated circuit. You have to modify that layout. And then the last limitation is you have to make the chip, which, of course, may take a factory and a few billion dollars, but that's the way the claim is written. The claim specifies that a portion of the metal containing interconnect layers in that layout file are to be used for electrical interconnection. A layout file simply contains representations of the components of an integrated circuit. Those representations don't carry electricity. They're simply 2D geometric shapes. Instead, representations of the metal components are shown being used for electrical interconnection in such a design when they are designed with a representation of metal between them to directly connect them. And that's all the claim requires. And that's what Kanaoka shows with M1 and M2. The M1 is portion of the metal containing interconnect layers, no dispute, I believe, M2 as well. They are electrically connected together. Kanaoka says that twice. We believe deliberately to say that they are connected with that metal.
But what do you mean about the word used? Used for electrical interconnection. That sure sounds like an active description of something that involves electricity.
And well,
as I understand it, your position is this structure does not have to have
the structures
used for electrical.
That's correct. I think the structures
induction.
The way we would put it is this: M1 is used to connect to M2. The connection is with these vias called TH1, vias through holes. M1 is used for that electrical interconnection. It's a deliberate process of the design. This is, again, we're in a layout file. So at one point, VLSI was saying below, I will admit this, that they were saying the claim required that you be connected to active circuitry. But that doesn't fit with a layout file. It's certainly a distinct requirement that's actually affirmatively there in claim one, which is not such an odd method claim.
But what if the claim just means at least available for electrical interconnection?
Well, again, we would submit that Kanaoka is. Kanaoka, again, M1 is not just available for electrical interconnection. It is there connected
to
M2. Well,
what if we conclude that the type of electrical connection going on in Kanaoka is not the kind of electrical interconnection that's being contemplated in this claim, in that the so-called electrical connection going on in Kanaoka is really two metal dummy lines being connected with a piece of metal?
Sorry, did not
And therefore, that. Is completely, because it's insulated collectively, it's completely unavailable for use to be electrically interconnected with outside devices.
I would say a couple points to that. First, that's not what the claims require. It simply says used for electrical interconnection. The additional requirement that it's used for electrical interconnection to something that is capable of being an active component or of pushing electricity, we simply do not see in that claim.
What about the prosecution history, where the amendments that were made to claims 20 and to claim 1 include all of this new requirement about electrical interconnection? Claim 1 is much more clear about this, I think we could all agree. And in the remarks section, the applicant said, for these exact same reasons why claim 1 is now patentable over the prior art, claim 20 is likewise patentable over the prior art.
Right. Well,
in that way, equating the limitations that were added in claim 20 to the more specific limitations added in claim 1.
The similarities between claim 1 and claim 20 in terms of this amendment was that they both amended the claim to make it clear that these portions
are no longer connected to the bond path.
Are no longer connected to the bond path.
More to those amendments than just the mere phrase "not connected to the bond path."
It's well, the question then becomes: as a result of what? In claim one, it says as a result of being used for electrical interconnection to the active circuitry. In claim 20, it simply just says as a result of being used for electrical interconnection, not directly connected to the bond path. So, in both instances, you've done what we believe the patent holder intended to do to distinguish from the prior art. You have decoupled functionally M1 and M2 or the portions that are not directly connected to the bond pad from that bond pad. There's an important point that they wanted to make. It's not a structure that goes all the way up to the bond pad. In fact, you decouple it from that bond pad. So you have made them functionally independent. But then they amended the claim slightly differently in 1 and 20. We believe that's an important distinction.
I have a question about the amendment that was made.
Yes.
The amendment involved, with respect to 20, the language that we've been talking about, containing interconnect layers underlying the first bond pad and not electrically connected to the first bond pad, and then as a result of being used for electrical interconnection, not directly connected to the first bond, to the bond pad. Given the purpose, as you are explaining it, of the amendment, why wouldn't it have been fully sufficient to stop at the end of the words "and not electrically connected to the first bond pad," period, and not added the "as a result of being used for electrical interconnection, not directly connected to the bond pad"? Put it another way, what is that last clause, starting after first bond pad, doing?
It's still requiring something of that first portion. It's not connected to the bond pad as a result of being used for the electrical interconnection to something else. And in this case, and it says not directly connected to the bond pad. So,
well, it's already said it's not connected to the bond
pad. That's right. It does repeat itself twice there.
It doesn't seem to me to serve any purpose.
I guess what I would say is the second time it's talking about the bond pad, it says not directly connected to the bond pad. And so I think it's a fair inference to say as a result of being used for electrical interconnection requires that direct connection, literal direct metal connecting that portion to something else.
But you've already disposed of the direct or indirect connection with the words not electrically connected to the first bond pad. If you put a period after that, you're covered, direct or indirect.
I guess the way that you wouldn't be covered is if you just simply had that portion like M1 not connected to anything else. If M1 was just floating all by itself as a dummy line or whatever, then it would not be connected, electrically connected to anything else. And so that's the distinction. I'm not sure it adds a whole lot. I think, though, it is different than Claim 1. It is not an affirmative requirement that there's be an active pairing of electricity or active circuitry.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
All right, 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to be very brief. Just on the being used for electrical interconnection, they've never disputed my analogies with the pennies. It's like pennies under a table. They've never said there's any electrical use. That just can't be being used for electrical interconnection. Let me try to address the key issues on force region. Judge Chen, I believe you have, you're maybe making a potential inference that if the institution says X as to whether ODA is a die attach, I draw the different inference that if the final recent decision doesn't say that, it suggests it's not supported by the record.
And when you say it doesn't say that, what is the that?
I thought you were alluding, both in your questioning of me and my friend here, that the board in the institution decision made a potential finding that ODA is exhibiting forces during a die attach. It did not make that finding in the final written decision. And so I would draw an inference that the record did not support that. And this may get to the issue of appendix.
Can I ask you this? Mm-hmm. If we agree with the board that the Intel district court construction is incorrect, then what arguments do you have left?
I would repeat all the things I said before about...
That's what I didn't understand what you were talking about the last time, because you were talking about all the procedural stuff didn't allow them to deviate. Assume I disagree with you on everything, and that the board was allowed to deviate, it didn't have to adopt the district court, it's not bound by your agreement, then what's left in this case on force region?
So, Amaranth, I think their construction is plainly wrong.
Did you propose an alternative construction other than the district court one?
No, we never did. We always agreed with Intel's district court construction.
So we don't have another construction that you say they should have adopted in lieu of the district court one?
No, all I can say is they should have adopted district court construction, and the construction they did adopt is wrong.
But what if force region is defined by the limitation language, all that additional limitation language?
I would submit to Your Honor that would be a disfavored construction under Amaranth, and I believe the case is similar.
But so, what if we conclude that's the correct construction? Then it's an affirm.
If you reject all of my other arguments, it would be an affirm.
About SAS? And
well, but also, I really think if this court holds that a board does not need to address and give weight to a district court claim instruction,
We're not going to hold that. We're going to hold that they did because they considered it the actual construction being urged.
Fair enough.
They may not have actually typed out, by the way, we looked at this.
I do think there's a distinction between a party's construction and district court's construction, so that's what I would say to that. I think on Appendix 30, if you read Appendix 28 to 30, there's no possible reading of the final written decision that would suggest that the board found that ODA is exhibiting forces during a die attach. It is simply applying its own construction. And then, Judge Bryson, you asked a lot of questions about flip chip, die attach versus wire bonding. I think there's a vast record on that question. And I think...
But does any of that vast record tell us what the patent drafters thought they were encompassing with the term die attach?
I think there are clues.
There are clues, did you say?
Yeah. So the patent is in the main, it's about flip chip. And in flip chip, sometimes you have wire bonds, but usually you don't. Usually the connections and the die attach, it's a single step. And so when it's talking about flip, die attach in the context of flip chip, it's definitely not talking about wire
bonds. That's a pressure bond?
Yes. Yes. Heat and pressure.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? If not, I appreciate Your Honor's time.
Thanks very much. The case is submitted.